This is Sustainable Long Island, a monthly series about how land use, water resources, energy, transportation, and food impact the environment of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As sea level rises, East Hampton will transform into a series of islands by 2070. That's the conclusion of the town's Coastal Assessment and Resilience Draft Plan issued this month. As reported by the East Hampton Star, the draft plan is meant to guide implementation of policies and projects to reduce the town's vulnerability and facilitate adaptation to a changing environment. The plan was prepared by consultants to the town, including Allison Branco, the Nature Conservancy's Acting Director of Climate Adaptation, who co-chairs the CARP Planning Committee. I spoke with Allison Branco this week. Here's our conversation. Allison Branco, welcome to Sustainable Long Island.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking here about the draft plan that was developed by the Coastal Assessment Resilience Plan. And it says right out of the beginning, sea level rise will transform East Hampton into a series of islands with permanent submergence of low-lying areas as early as 2070. This was what has gotten a lot of attention. The picture of East Hampton as islands appeared in the newspaper. I went and I tried to squint at the map and saw that my house is likely underwater, which was terrifying. I mean, I won't be alive then, but this is the family home for generations, and I would like succeeding generations to be able to enjoy it. So talk about the CARP and how this conclusion was reached.
I think that projection is scary to a lot of folks. So projections about where water will rise and how that will affect East Hampton come from primarily government sources of data. In this case, New York State has some official sea level rise projections. And also we look to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as well as the International Panel on Climate Change, for their predictions of what will happen to air temperature and how that will impact sea level rise. So that's where those numbers come from. And it's really all about the elevation. So depending on the elevation of the land surface, as water rises, models, we call them bathtub models, electronically in a computer flood the land that's low-lying. And that's how we develop those maps that will show areas that will be potentially permanently inundated by the end of the century.
An issue for people who are even in higher elevations is that the roads are generally along the coastline, you know, near the beaches, and they're going to be submerged. So what is the town thinking in terms of roads?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, and that's just true all across Long Island. A lot of our major arteries that run east-west are vulnerable in several different areas. And so in the long term, that's going to mean the need for a lot more bridges than roads at ground level, essentially, to be able to get from one end to the other. And that's certainly true in East Hampton, where you could sort of imagine, like that figure shows, a series of islands, almost like an archipelago in 100 or 150 years. That might really be what we're dealing with. So long-term planning, infrastructure planning, capital budgets need to account for that and be able to build bridges between these higher elevation areas to span the more floodable parts.
So we've been talking about sea level rise. Oh, and there is one more thing to talk about. That this is something I brought up in previous episodes of this show. Saltwater intrusion in our aquifer. What are the dangers there?
Yeah, that's a really important impact of sea level rise. So as the sea level rises, it pushes groundwater up higher, closer to the ground surface. And it also pushes the seawater further inland, essentially, so in the fresh groundwater. And that sort of divide between the fresh and salty groundwater is going to move inland and upward a little bit as sea level continues to rise. So that, because on Long Island, we are drinking our groundwater, it is our only source of fresh water for drinking, we need to be really watching out for that. And especially on the East End, where a lot of folks are on private wells and not public water, it could start to impact more and more private wells will get salty and unusable for drinking. And so in the future, there may be some additional infrastructure needs to expand the public drinking water infrastructure to more areas as private wells get less usable. And it's also really important in terms of flooding. So because sea level is going to push the groundwater up and closer to the ground surface, that will cause flooding for folks who have basements in a lot of low-lying areas. And it can also impact the success of septic systems. So the septic system regulations are all based on the distance from that system to the groundwater. So as groundwater comes up, more and more systems will become out of compliance, even with the older septic system regulations. So yet another reason that it's really important everyone in East Hampton starts trying to take advantage of town and county grants and get their septic systems upgraded.
Those upgraded septic systems won't be vulnerable?
Well, they'll be much less vulnerable because they work in a different way. There are new technologies so that the leaching of the partially treated water can happen much closer to the ground surface. And so with those upgrades, you can make a system that was once out of compliance because the groundwater rose too close to it. You can redesign the system, keep everything much more shallow, and get it into compliance.
Now let's talk about the MR word, the managed retreat word. This report, the CARP, and we are talking with Allison Branco, who is on East Hampton's CARP committee, the Coastal Assessment Resilience Plan Committee, and also is with the Nature Conservancy. This plan discusses the need for managed retreat. Explain what managed retreat is, how this is being talked about and being applied to Montauk in particular. And then I'll ask you if there are also other areas in the town and on the East End that are looking at this solution.
There sure are other areas. So managed retreat is actually a terrible term that I think invokes a lot of sort of giving up mentality in folks. But what it really talks about is making way for water. Rather than fighting against the rising water that we know is coming, it talks about sort of backing up and making space for that water on our own terms. And I think the alternative to managed retreat is not staying where you are, because the water is going to push people out. So the alternative to managed retreat is an unmanaged situation where a lot of hardship and destruction happens in order to get people to move out of the way. So managed retreat talks about kind of planning proactively, figuring out ways, helping people move to safe high ground, creating incentives for businesses that need to move, things like that, so that people can be assisted financially, so it can be done in a fair and equitable way, and so that you can sort of envision a new future for your town with a lot more water and kind of handle all of the climate change impacts on our terms rather than just waiting for the water to come and see what happens. Because we know if we do that, we'll have a lot of pain and hardship in the process.
Yeah, well, this is kind of political TNT. How is the buy-in going to happen? How is the pot going to be sweetened for people to choose to make this move?
Yes, it is a very political hot button item. And that's because we're talking about people's homes and businesses, you know, their livelihoods, their identity, the place they love. Especially in East Hampton, it's very common for people to own a home and intend to pass it down for multiple generations. And the fact that you might have to think about giving that up and changing that plan and doing that with a different house somewhere else is a really hard thing for folks. And we don't ever want to make light of that. But unfortunately, the fact of the matter is the water is going to require it. It's just going to come and there's nothing we can do. It's a very big ocean. There's no holding it back. So it is a very hard thing. And so what we need to do is plan programs to help people through the process. Essentially, we want to make it beneficial for folks. So at the very bare minimum, we need to get some government funding to pay people for their houses. Because without that, then they aren't going to be able to go and move to a different house. So that's first and foremost. And, you know, in Montauk especially, it's not homes we're talking about in most cases. It's really more the downtown business district. In that case, often, and what this plan recommends is something called the Transfer of Development Rights Program, which some people might be familiar with because it's been used in the Pine Barrens. But the idea is essentially, if you have a business in this area that needs to back up from the water, you would be given access to land in a higher and drier place. And what you would aim to do is choose an area and hope that a lot of businesses would relocate to the same general vicinity so that you could almost like recreate that sort of business district feel that you currently have very close to the water and in danger in another part of town. But you know, you want to do what you can to keep those businesses near each other, because there's obviously a lot of business and sort of, you know, like the feel of Montauk. You would want to try to recreate that to the extent possible in a new area. So likely that will mean development rights would be granted to folks moving out. Likely other financial incentives might be needed. There's a lot of details to still figure out in terms of how exactly that might be done, because this is it's not brand new, but it's a much less common circumstance. In the past, after hurricanes especially, we have seen buyouts of homes. And typically when that happens, FEMA or some other government agency will come in and buy people's houses from them. The idea is you want to try to give people fair market value before it was damaged. And so the goal here would be either to do it after a storm, or ideally in a more proactive way and not go through all of that damage and destruction in the process.
The plan outlines beach nourishment for 15 years. This is taking sand from elsewhere and either, you know, filling up these geo bags with it or just dumping it on the beach, as far as I understand. Some experts say it will make the problem worse. It'll destroy the seafloor, take money from more long-term resilience, and accelerate the scouring of adjacent areas. What's your response to that?
Yeah, there are a few components of that. So certainly removing sand from offshore to bring it onto the beach is damaging whatever is out there, wherever you're taking it from. And all the, you know, there are some permitting processes to make sure that that damage is minimized. You know, it's not simple, and it always is going to do damage. Onshore, some of the concerns are, first of all, it's a temporary solution. Essentially, you're just providing the ocean some different sand grains to erode away. It's always going to be an erosive place if it's a beach. And so it's a very short-term solution. And as Montauk has learned the hard way, it's a solution that requires very, very high maintenance costs, very frequent replacement of sand, because you put it down and it immediately starts washing away again. And so every year to 4 years, they're having to put new sand on the beach there in Montauk. And that would be true if all you were putting there was sand. And then even worse is these geotubes, which are sometimes marketed as a more soft solution, but they're really not. They're sort of a buried wall with sand on top of it. And anytime you harden the shoreline like that, or people are probably more familiar with a bulkhead, which is usually like a metal or wooden wall at the shoreline, any of those hard solutions just reflect the wave energy around them, and they cause a lot more erosion on the upstream and downstream sides of them. And so there is a lot of concern about any solutions like that, that are putting hard structures in there, are actually enhancing the erosion that would naturally be happening. And then the last problem with those types of solutions, both sand placement alone or with geotubes or other hard structures, it gives people a false sense of security that this shoreline can stay put forever. And that's just not true. And, you know, certainly the funding is not infinite. And although it seems like there's so much of it out there, sand is not an infinite resource. And it's not just us. It's all up and down the entire East Coast. Every beach is having this problem because the water is rising. And so every beach wants a bunch of sand. So the sand is a finite resource, as are the boats that do the dredging and sand placement, and the consultants that create the plans and calculate the volumes of sand, and all of those things are finite resources. And we're trying to share them with the whole East Coast. And so we really are going to run out at some point. So between that and a false sense of security, it's an okay short-term solution. But what's happening now with this plan is we're using the time we're getting by implementing that short-term solution to figure out a more long-term solution, such as backing up a little bit from the water.
This is Sustainable Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Allison Branco of the Nature Conservancy about East Hampton Town's Coastal Assessment and Resilience Draft Plan. So another thing I just wonder if the CARP has addressed is, you know, the funding for this. Federal funding is very uncertain. It depends on an administration that is friendly to these things. Local funding is dependent on a property tax base that, you know, might be nice and fat now, but when these problems get more acute, people may be packing up and leaving. You know, there may be more climate refugees from this area, and property values could go down. The other issue is insurance, you know, pulling out of the area. It's already done so in many ways. So how is the funding going to work?
Well, one thing that's important to remember is that this plan actually should save the town money, because it costs a lot more to, it costs a lot less, excuse me, to prevent a problem than it does to solve it after the fact. And so right now, East Hampton is spending millions of dollars every year placing sand on the beach just in Montauk, not to mention all of the disaster recovery costs. You know, people can't get to work because their road is flooded. The costs are tremendous in our current situation. So we have to make sure that we remember that that's the baseline we're comparing to. And in the long run, planning for sea level rise and preparing for sea level rise should save the town money in tremendously increased disaster costs and cleanup costs and rebuilding costs and all of that. Not to mention, you said, if we're not prepared for climate change and we're not sort of recreating a new version of East Hampton that can live with all this water, then we do have the potential to drive down house prices, people move out, the economy suffers. But if we sort of get ahead of it, because we have such good science and data to tell us what's coming, so we're in a great position to be able to get ahead of it. If we can do that, then we should be able to maintain a healthy economy, a place that people want to continue to come. If we stop trying to hold the land still, we can preserve the beaches that are one of the main reasons people love East Hampton. Likewise, water quality, the bayside shorelines, all of those, you know, if we sort of protect them and stop trying to make them do what we want and sort of give them a little bit of space and let that water do its thing, then we'll have an East Hampton that people want to live in and visit for a much longer term. So it really will save money in the long run. But it is true, some of these projects, including buying a lot of high-priced houses, will require some big slugs of funding. And there is potential for federal funding for these kinds of things. In the short term, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act is a really great pot of federal money that will be coming out over the next five-ish years. And that will be a great opportunity for East Hampton to take advantage of and hopefully do some of the projects recommended in this plan. FEMA is constantly providing funding after disasters, and more they're starting to steer money into pre-disaster projects because they recognize as well that it costs less to prevent the disaster than to clean it up afterwards. So there is potential for some state and federal assistance, but also in the long run, this will save East Hampton money.
So then what about things like building codes and zoning? How does this work into the recommendations of this plan? How are you going to get local builders on board?
Yeah, there are a lot of recommendations about building and zoning in this plan as well, because those are some of the tools that the town already has that can really help this situation. For example, considering whether we want to be rebuilding in all of the super vulnerable areas. You know, if homes are damaged, do we want to allow folks to rebuild, or do we need to then buy the house instead and help them rebuild elsewhere? There are just some very basic stuff with the building code, like the height of a home. You know, after hurricanes, you often see houses being raised. And there are a lot of rules and regulations about how high they have to go and what sea level rise projections you might want to base that on. So there's some things the town can do there. Of course, if you ask people to raise their house, then they can quickly start to bump up against height limits. So sometimes adjustments have to be made to those to allow houses to be raised. So there are a lot of things like that, both how you build a house so that it's more resilient to flooding or storms, as well as where we are building, trying to concentrate any new building out of the vulnerable area and into those high and dry, safer places where they can have a much longer life.
And finally, we haven't talked about extreme weather. And of course, this is the other great threat. I mean, it threatens the shoreline, but, you know, the hurricane of 38 is something that the report refers to repeatedly. First of all, just tell us what the damage of the hurricane of 38 was like. And I gather from the report, even, well, Hurricane Sandy actually was a tropical storm out here on the island. But, you know, I gather we haven't had a storm as serious as that. But this report says the chances of having a storm like 38 or worse are quite high, given climate, the climate crisis.
So There are two impacts really that this plan is aiming to address. One is sort of the slow moving disaster of sea level rise, where the water rises slowly but permanently. And then the other really important one is storms. So the hurricane of 38 is the last sort of big one that Long Island had out here on the East End. Western Suffolk was much more damaged during Superstorm Sandy, which was barely even a hurricane when it got to Long Island. But what we are seeing with climate change is that the very large and very strong storms are becoming more frequent. So a storm like the hurricane of 38, which was once thought to be kind of a 1% chance recurrence, is now getting to be more frequent. So it's more like a 2% chance or a 5% chance.
1% chance per year or per century, per 500 years?
Per year. So often you hear people talk about the 100-year storm, and that is not a great name because it implies that it should only happen once every 100 years when that's actually not the case. It's just a statistical figure, which means that any given year, there is a 1% chance of having a storm like that. So the hurricane of 38 was one of these 1% chance storms. So every year, this year, there's a 1% chance that we will have a storm that strong. It does not mean that it will come every 100 years. And so what's happening is that as sea level rises, those frequencies are getting greater. So now we're looking at more like, let's see, the plan says the chance of experiencing a flood event similar to the hurricane of 38 at least once is about 60% in the next 30 years. So if you bought a house today and you had a 30-year mortgage, there would be a 60% chance of a hurricane of 38 level flood happening to that house during the course of your mortgage, for example. That's a very high percentage. So over time, those storms are getting stronger and the strong ones are getting more frequent.
So how can we protect ourselves against those kinds of storms? Is that something that comes up in building codes, disaster response?
Yeah. The plan does not go into a lot of detail about disaster response, other than to just remind folks that it's going to become more and more and more important. And I think importantly, disaster response becomes very difficult when you have a lot of road flooding. So that's one of the reasons that road flooding is really important to address, because we need to be able to get to people. Or in some cases, it might mean, you know, not necessarily planning for all of the roads to be above flood level. It may involve buying more amphibious equipment or more boats for the emergency responders, because that may actually be a more practical way. So there are a lot of different things that could be considered, but emergency response is definitely important. And the other thing to remember is that anything you're doing that will protect you from sea level rise, such as backing up from the water, also helps you in a storm. Unlike raising a house can help you during a hurricane, you know, it can help keep your belongings and your walls dry when water levels rise because of a hurricane, as long as you're far enough back that you're not getting too much wind damage. It can protect you during a short-term flood because you can just leave, you know, for 3 days while the hurricane is here, and then the water goes out and you can come back to a raised house. But with sea level rise, that's not so practical because the roads will be flooded permanently. Even if your house is above flood level, everything around it might be flooded. So that's why in the most vulnerable areas, raising houses isn't always the best idea, because it may help you with a storm surge that's temporary, but it won't be as practical for that permanent sea level rise. So we see home raising is more practical on shorelines where the energy is less, you know, not the beach facing shorelines, and also back a little ways where you're not susceptible to that chronic flooding already, but where you have some time and where you might only have to deal with major storm surge flooding.
So that brings us, of course, back full circle to Manage Retreat. It really underscores the need for people to move inland. I assume that that's also going to have to change the density zoning allowances, because you're going to have a smaller space that you're going to need to locate more people in.
That's absolutely right. So Montauk is one of the areas targeted for Manage Retreat being a good possible solution. Some other places include the area around Akabonic Harbor, especially Girard Drive and Last Point, and potentially Lazy Point as well, have all been discussed in this plan as possible candidates for Managed Retreat. And it's true, because we want to keep all of those folks in East Hampton, ideally in the hamlets that they're in. We want to keep them part of their community. We want to keep them close to their jobs, kids close to schools, all of those things. we need to make space for them elsewhere. And so that may involve changing zoning in some of the higher and drier inland areas and allowing some more building so that there are places for these folks that are backing up from the water to move into. So that's why this is going to require sort of like a bigger planning effort on the part of the town and not just, you know, showing up and buying houses for people and saying good luck and goodbye, because we want to keep them in the community. So the town is going to have to really take a town-wide look at where the opportunities are to add density. And, you know, there are a lot of other advantages too. If you're going to put in sewage treatment, that's a good place to add density. Maybe if you have a little business district that's struggling, that's a great place to add density. So it really requires a sort of comprehensive view of the needs of the town. And East Hampton has come a long way already in that type of planning with the Hamlet plans, for example. So I think they're well poised to take this look at the coastal areas that need, that people could move to and be safer, and that we could absorb that additional density without a lot of problems. And then the other thing is that everybody needs to remember, even if your own home is not impacted, the town as a whole is impacted. It's going to cost the town a lot of money. They're going to have to spend a lot of time and energy planning. And so you're lucky to be in East Hampton where they are trying to get ahead of it and plan for it. But it's, of course, going to affect the whole economy of town. And so even when your house is not threatened, people need to get involved with what the town is doing overall, because it is really critical to kind of the viability of the town long term. And also, there is a recommendation in the plan for a real estate disclosure, which is something that some states have. Most states have terrible real estate disclosure laws, including ours. But, you know, I hear stories over and over and over again. This house was flattened by the last hurricane. This house has a chronic flooding problem, and nobody told me when I was buying it. And people come in and they invest all of their savings into this building that is then just getting slowly destroyed. So that's an interesting recommendation that the town is going to have to grapple with. And, you know, the real estate agency has had mixed opinions about that kind of disclosure law. But I think more and more it's going to become necessary nationwide so that people at least know what they're getting into. You know, if you can afford to have a disposable house, that's one thing. But if you're going to put all of your net worth into a house, you should know if it's vulnerable or not.
Well, Allison Branco, you are one of the members of the Coastal Assessment Resiliency Plan Committee of the Town of East Hampton. You're also with the Nature Conservancy. Thank you so much for a fascinating dive into this draft plan.
Thank you so much for talking about it with me.
This is Sustainable Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We heard my conversation with Allison Branco, the Nature Conservancy's Acting Director of Climate Adaptation, about East Hampton Town's Coastal Assessment and Resilience Draft Plan. Sustainable Long Island is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at 6:30 a.m. and 8 p.m., and also on the second Saturday each month at 9 a.m. Programs are archived at www.sustainableli.blogspot.com. Go to our website for a link to the East Hampton Town's Coastal Assessment and Resilience Draft Plan. Sustainable Long Island is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.